say his father's name. Chapter 32. In a nest of luxury high above Wilshire Boulevard, where the tall windows present a sky afire above a city settling toward the pleasures of day's end. Although he isn't at the moment acting on behalf of Volunteers for a Better Future, Jason Allen Drucklow cannot resist using the back door into the NSA's 10,000-room castle of data to satisfy his curiosity about Jane Hawke. He wants to know what happened at the abandoned factory, but also whatever else she has done that Marshall Ackerman and his many associates have been sharing with one another by phone and in their various encrypted messages. She fascinates Jason. Not as Cammy fascinates him, no need for the lovely Ms. Newton to be concerned, but rather as fate fascinates him, as the possibility of strange alien intelligences elsewhere in the universe fascinates him. Hawk Woman, as they have taken to calling her, is no less an interest of Cammy's than of Jason's. As he uncovers each new morsel of information about what she has done, he shares it with his best girl. Indeed, Cammy is the one who compares Hawk Woman to one of those computer viruses that changes its digital footprint each time it replicates, which makes it undetectable to most antivirus software. As she pours a glass of Camus Cabernet Sauvignon for each of them, here on the cusp of night, she says, "Wow! She's like a polymorphic virus, huh?" This sobers Jason before he's taken a sip of wine.
"Polymorphic virus? Maybe we better hope not. Don't want anything to happen to this cushy job."
Part 3. Road Trip. Chapter 1. Minutes after Jane's arrival at the house in rural Orange County, in the early dark, with the moon not yet afloat on the eastern sky, Travis took her to the stable behind the house, the crisp leaves of live oaks crunching underfoot.
"See, Exmoor ponies come from England," the boy told her excitedly. "This one, she was born here, but they're from England. Ponies were in England like 10,000 years before people. They had scary saber-toothed tigers then, and these giant old mastodons. The tigers and mastodons, they're gone long ago, but not Exmoor ponies. Exmoor ponies are forever."
The hanging lamps in the center aisle poured brandy-colored light onto a floor embedded with hoof-stamped bits of straw. Drifts of soft shadows smoothed the corners and sabled those stalls that were empty. Bella and Samson stood side by side in their enclosures, craning their necks over the half doors, nickering hello, tails swishing across stall boards. Jane and Travis would visit the mare and stallion, but not before he introduced her to the survivor of saber-tooths that waited across the way from the larger horses, in a stall with a door cut lower. She was a bay mare with a darker brown mane. Her eyes were large and wide apart, and suggestive of keen intelligence.
"Isn't she really beautiful?"
Travis asked.
"She really is."
"Her name's Hannah. We just got her Tuesday."
Hannah had a clean throat latch and fine neck, shoulders well laid back, a deep, wide chest. The pony was full grown, standing at most 12 hands high, no more than 49 or 50 inches, yet it seemed too big for the boy. Although Jane knew her concern was exaggerated, if not entirely misplaced, she said, "You're careful with her?"
"Yeah, sure. She's real gentle."
"She's strong and she can kick."
"She never kicks me."
"You better always wear your helmet when you ride."
"Yeah, I can mount by myself already, Mom. I can ride, kind of. We don't ride fast. It's Gavin and me, not just me myself."
"You always do what Gavin tells you with horses."
"I will. Yeah, I do."
She put an arm around the boy and pulled him against her side, counseling herself not to leave him with memories only of a nagging mom. I'm proud of you, cowboy.
When did Daddy learn to ride?
Raised on a Texas ranch, probably as young as you.
He did rodeo.
He did indeed, before he joined the Marines.
Can we go there, to Texas, someday?
You were there once, but you were just three.
I kind of remember, but I don't.
When all this is over, we'll go again. Your grandma and grandpa are great people.
You got to watch me ride tomorrow.
I have to be on the road early, but I'll wait to see you ride. I wouldn't miss that. He'd brought two quartered apples in a large paper cup. He fed two pieces to Hannah, and the pony took them almost quicker than the eye could follow, blessed as it was with prehensile lips peculiar to its breed.
I miss my dad, Travis said softly.
I miss him too. Very much.
I wish he was here to see me ride.
He sees you, Trav. You don't see him anymore, but he sees you every day. And he's proud, too. Chapter 2. At Gavin and Jessica Washington's kitchen table, conversation and food were equal parts of every dinner. For his age, Travis was engaged and engaging, but well-mannered, a joy to his mother. Table talk ranged from the experiences of the day to books, music, horses, hot rods. Gavin had chopped and channeled and fully customized an apple green 48 Ford pickup and was starting another such project. No mention was made of most wanted lists or news stories about a rogue agent. She'd never told Travis that his father committed suicide. She told him what she knew in her heart, that Nick had been murdered, which was a frightful thing for a child to absorb and accept. The boy believed that his mother remained in the FBI as part of a team searching for the murderer. This was, of course, a lie, though it had the virtue of being a lie that ought to be the truth, that would be the truth in a world less corrupt than this one. As usual, Jessica rose from the table when anything more was wanted by anyone, loath to delegate. She didn't mind being in part defined by her ink-black hair, Cherokee complexion, and striking good looks, but she refused to be defined whatsoever by the fact that she lost both legs below the knees after an IED in Afghanistan did to her, an army non-combatant, what its makers intended to do to armed soldiers. Her prosthetics ended in blade-like feet that seemed not to hamper her. She gracefully negotiated the kitchen, avoiding the dogs, Queenie and Duke, who chose to settle where they offered the most challenging obstacle course. Jess had been a Blade Runner for 9 years, married to Gavin for 8, and his obvious devotion to her was one reason Jane felt comfortable leaving Travis here. The Washingtons had no children of their own, but Gavin interacted with the boy as a good father would, truly interested in him, drawing him out, making him laugh. In the days ahead, regardless of what happened to Jane, her son would be safe and loved. Her gratitude for such friends was beyond her power to put into words. Nonetheless, an unreasonable resentment spun its web in a cramped corner of her heart, and sorrow, perilously close to self-pity, overcame her at the thought that, were she to die for her child, she would lose him just as she would have lost him if she'd never fought to save him. Chapter 3. The boy had been in bed an hour and a half when Jane returned to his room after spending time with Jessica and Gavin. In the low lamplight, Travis lay on his side, one loosely fisted hand against his mouth, as if he had fallen asleep while chewing on a knuckle to keep himself awake. As previously, on these rare visits, she settled for the night in an armchair, wrapped in a blanket, watching over him. She slept fitfully. and each time she woke, the sight of him was antidote to the poison of her dreams. As the tide of sleep, having ebbed, flowed to her once more, she wondered if against all odds she might triumph over David James Michael and his confederacy of elitist sociopaths, only to become so ruthless in the process as to lose her humanity and find herself incapable of mothering a child of such perfect innocence. In the courtroom of dreams, standing before jurors who turned upon her faces as featureless as eggshells, she was convicted of abandoning her son. She fled when a judge sentenced her to a purging of her memory that would erase all awareness of having brought a child into the world. But every door through which she escaped only brought her into the same courtroom, to the same eggshell faces, and the same judge, and the same cruel judgment. Chapter 4. This was goodbye weather, the overcast sky allowing a gray light of such pathos that nothing on the earth could cast a shadow, as if the house and the stable and the oak trees under which they stood lacked the substance to paint their shapes upon the ground. This morning, just another dream conjuration in an existence of eternal sleep. Jane stood with Jessica to watch the sweet boy mount the Exmoor pony and take the reins. He was briefly awkward, clambering astride Hannah, but then confident in the saddle, helmeted against falls and saber-toothed tigers. He waved, and Jane waved, and he set off with Gavin, who was riding Samson, across the exercise yard and through an open gate in the ranch-style fence, onto one of the trails that wound through hills of chaparral greener after the seasonal rains than they would be most of the year. The German shepherds accompanied the riders as far as the gate, but the dogs knew the limits of their license and returned to sit with the women under the shadeless trees, their tails sweeping two arcs of ground, clearing away the crisp oval leaves fallen from the live oaks. "Where now?" Jess asked, her attention still on the receding figures. "Better you don't know."
"Will we see you in a week or two?"
"Probably not."
"You need money?"
"No.
Because we received the $30,000 you mailed last week. We put it with the rest."
"I took it from a guy with extreme desires. He liked totally submissive girls, incapable of disobedience. He drew a gun on me, and I wasn't as submissive as he preferred."
"You don't need to explain anything to me.
I know you aren't out there robbing banks."
"I wish it were that easy."
Man and stallion, with boy and pony, came to the brow of a hill and poised atop it, like a still from a movie in the tradition of Shane, from an age of hope, when honor and a sense that right would always win suffused the land. Then, under hoof, the crown of the hill became a farther slope, on which man and boy descended out of sight, as though they would ride beyond the mountains of the moon, all the way to El Dorado. Chapter 5. North, on Interstate 15 to Barstow, into the true desert of sand and eons-old rock and Joshua trees like spiny totems of some ancient humanoid race long extinct, and then east on Interstate 40, coastal clouds feathering away to blue sky, air so clear that the Saturday sun blazed white instead of yellow. Iron Furnace, Kentucky was a long drive away, but facial recognition software matched to airport terminal and train station cameras made quicker travel dangerous. Having cut her own hair short, she now wore long auburn hair, contact lenses tinting her blue eyes green, and makeup she didn't need. Facial recognition scanning, however, would see through those superficial changes and ID her by the unique measurements, shapes, and relationships of her features. In the air or on the rails, she was vulnerable to capture on arrival. having been identified in the minutes after departure, if not even before. Jessica had packed her off with a thermos of black coffee, as well as power bars sweetened with fruit and honey, so that she could meet the empty miles on a caffeine and sugar high. A radar detector and laser foiler ensured a legal velocity through the speed traps. Determined to reach Flagstaff, Arizona, in 9 hours, she navigated the California Mojave, past Pisgah Crater, through the Bullion Mountains, through 150 miles of wasteland to the Colorado River. She came into Arizona, past far buttes and nearer Slick Rock, through a landscape of sage and agave, guided by a map and experience, stopping for fuel and a bathroom break in Kingman. She traveled by the grace of music. To keep her spirits up, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, and the little-known Teddy Wilson, the best pianist of the big band period. The farther her son receded in her wake, the less effect dance music had on her mood. The arid, empty land, bespeaking 10,000 years of rock-splitting weather, born of cataclysmic forces both volcanic and tectonic, called for Bob Dylan, early to mid-career. At 4:05 in the afternoon, having gained an hour transiting from Pacific time to Mountain time, she arrived in Flagstaff, on schedule. 9 hours counted as a hard haul, but any cross-country drive was better begun with a first-day marathon, when the driver had not yet been numbed by the vastness of the undertaking. She planned to make it to Albuquerque, another 325 miles, before stopping for the night, or, failing that, at least 187 miles to gallop. They said that man proposes, God disposes, but what happened next to delay her was not the work of God. Although she had drunk the coffee in the thermos as well as more that she had bought in Kingman, she'd eaten only one of the power bars. She wasn't much for sugar, but she was a lioness for protein. She left the interstate for a truck stop, bigger than some towns, and topped off the gas tank and parked and went into the restaurant for an early dinner. People whose work was the highway did not eat all to the same schedule, but 4:15 was early for dinner, even among those who timed their day by miles rather than by minutes. Because there were maybe 30 customers in a space able to accommodate at least 6 times that many, Jane didn't take a stool at the counter, but settled in a booth by a window with a clear view of the parking lot beyond which 18-wheelers passed on their way to Islands of Pumps. The waitress brought a menu and a cheerful attitude. She took an order for milk, with which Jane intended to wash down a maximum-strength acid reducer, and turned away with the assurance that she would be back in a jiff. Aware of being watched by 3 guys at a table near the center of the room, Jane scanned the menu, looking over the top of it from time to time to assess what it was that interested them. They were drinking beers, Coronas with lime slices, sharing nachos and French fries topped with cheese, in their late 20s. Cowboy boots and engineer boots, stonewashed black denim on one, blue jeans for the other two, one with a shaved head and an earring, one with shaved sides and hair on top, a postage-stamp beard between lower lip and chin. The third looked fresh-scrubbed and sported a hairstyle more common on 50s television than in the world of now, as if, at times, he found it advantageous to pass for a church boy. What they said to one another didn't travel, but they were quick to laugh, and the laughter had a caustic edge, a snicker of contempt, which was especially the case when they were focused on Jane. She could relax. They made no connection between her and the most wanted stories on TV. Their interest was sexual, and nothing would come of that but the disappointment with which they must be profoundly familiar. They were most likely just 3 dudes starting early on their Saturday night, hoping for action of some kind, which would end up being video games. When the waitress brought the milk, Jane ordered 2 dinners, an 8-ounce steak and roast chicken on the same plate, hold the potatoes, double the veggies.
You don't look like the kind of girl could put away all that, the waitress said.
Just watch me. After she took an acid reducer with a long swallow of milk and set the glass on the table, she discreetly regarded the three men. The one with the shaved head was on a cell phone, staring at her intently. When he realized she might be looking at him, he at once shifted his attention to the beer in front of him. He spoke into the phone for half a minute more and terminated the call and drank from the bottle. Maybe the call he'd made had been about her. Probably not. She didn't look enough like herself to be identified so easily. Paranoia could be a tool for survival. It could also be an engine of unreason and lethal panic. He was just a guy on a phone. The waitress brought her dinner.
Bet you was raised on a farm like me.
Many have said so. These days, she wielded knife and fork with machine efficiency, eating like someone condemned, determined not to run out of time before she ran out of food. As she ate, she watched the three men surreptitiously. She was not their sole interest. They were scoping out a couple at another table, or rather the well-built brunette who was half of the couple. At yet another table sat two women and two girls. The older of the women appeared to be about 50, the younger one 30, both attractive and enough alike to be mother and daughter. The sisters looked 9 and 11, a lively but well-behaved pair. Perhaps the laughter of the men seemed softer and more guarded, nervous and with a darker snicker, when their attention was on the family of four. They leaned over the table to share their comments in voices lowered even further than when they seemed to be talking about Jane. Other than such small and perhaps meaningless suggestions of bad intentions, she could not say what inspired a trilling from her lowest vertebra to highest. This brief tinnitus in the spinal fluid was the way that, in certain situations, her intuition spoke to her. You're the law. Pay attention to this. The very signature of evil in the world. Chapter 6. Jane adjusted the pace of her eating to the rhythm of whatever scene was playing out with the three men, who had by now focused exclusively on the grandmother, mother, and two young girls. The targets, if that's what they were, appeared unaware that they were the objects of scrutiny. In a time when the multitudes of the earth seemed to be dividing rapidly into just two categories, prey and predators, it was remarkable how unattuned the gazelles could be to the gathering leopards all around them. The family of four ordered dessert, and when it was served, the three watchful men stopped talking. They quickly finished the latest round of beers, dropped a meager tip on the table, and went to the cashier's station to pay, as if they had simultaneously recalled some important business for which they were late. Jane turned to the window. The three soon appeared in the parking lot and went to an old flatback Jeep Cherokee. No bright work at all. Tinted windows. They huddled next to the Jeep, talking, and someone inside put down a window to join the discussion. Jane could not see who had opened the window, and then it rolled up. The three men got aboard and closed the doors, at least four of them now, in consultation behind the tinted glass. Maybe someone started the Cherokee's engine, but the vehicle didn't move. Jane asked for her check. When it came, she gave the waitress cash, including a 30% tip, and said, "I'll just sit here a few minutes digesting, if you don't mind." "Honey, you lay right down there and take a nap if you're of a mind to." By the time the two women and the girls received their check, the Jeep still waited outside. Jane went to a small reception area between the cashier's station and the front entrance. The older woman appeared first, offering the cashier a credit card. Her daughter and granddaughters joined her as she finished the transaction and put away the plastic. As they moved toward the front entrance, Jane stepped between them and the door. "Excuse me, but did you notice those three men drinking beer?" The older woman blinked at her.
"I'm sorry.
What?" "They're driving an SUV. They're waiting outside. I think it would be good if I walked with you to your car." The grandmother looked at her daughter.
"Did you see them, Sandra?"
Sandra frowned. "I saw them, but so what? They only had a couple beers." "They were watching you," Jane said.
"I didn't see them watching us."
"What does that mean, anyway, watching?"
"They were full of oats, goofing each other, that's all."
"They were watching you," Jane insisted, "and there's something not right about them."
"Not right? How?"
"They're nasty business. They're bad boys on the prowl."
"Are they really?"
"I know their type." Too late, Jane recognized Sandra's indignation, the glitter of moral disdain in her eyes.
"Their type? You mean Mexicans?"
"That's not what this is about,
isn't it?"
Sandra asked, as if she knew the answer and did not need to hear it. "One of them might have been Mexican," Jane said. "The second one, I don't know what. The third one was as white bread as Richie Cunningham. It's an equal opportunity crew."
"Holly? Lauren?"
Sandra brought her two children closer to her, as though the threat stood here before them rather than outside. To Jane, she said,
"What's this Richie business supposed to mean?"
"Happy days," the grandmother explained, pleased with her knowledge of trivia. "Ron Howard played Richie Cunningham."
"But what snarky thing does it really mean?" Sandra wondered.
Jane dared not claim she was an FBI agent, thereby giving them reason to remember what they might have seen on the news. Besides, any assertion that she possessed authority would result in a demand to see her badge.
"Look, it costs you nothing to let me walk with you. You've got these girls to think about."
Sandra raised her voice, for the first time attracting the cashier's attention.
"And if those men were trouble, what could you do anyway? Call them names?"
"I'm licensed to carry." Against her better judgment, Jane pulled back her sport coat to reveal the holstered pistol.
"This is bad," the grandmother said. "This is very bad. You can't just shoot Mexicans for drinking beer." "You get away from us with that," Sandra said, as if the pistol were a critical mass of plutonium. "Girls, we're going."
The cashier appeared about to step out from behind the counter, and Jane relented. Sandra guided Holly and Lauren toward the door, as her mother counseled Jane.
"Young lady, maybe you need help. There are fine therapists who could help. Hate isn't the answer to anything."
The cashier asked,
"Is something wrong?"
"A small misunderstanding," Jane assured her, and she followed the women and children outside, into the cool, crisp air and chrome sunlight and eastward-reaching shadows of this late afternoon in Flagstaff. Sandra hastened her daughters toward a parking area reserved for larger vehicles that were not commercial trucks, the grandmother hurrying behind them and glancing back as if Jane might be at her heels and transformed now into a hound with sulfurous breath. The first motorhome in the line was theirs, and they boarded on the starboard side. The flat black Jeep Cherokee drove out of the parking lot and toward the truck stop exit, but then pulled to the side of those lanes and stopped. If Jane hadn't been America's most wanted, if she'd possessed some genuine authority, if there hadn't been at least four in that old Cherokee, and if the likelihood wasn't 100% that one or all of the four would have weapons, she would have trusted her intuition and would have put her career at risk. She would have run the 50 or 60 yards to the damn Jeep and would have gotten the driver out of it and put him on the ground and held him on suspicion of intent. But that was a game of ifs and would-haves, none of it germane to what was here and now. The motorhome came toward Jane, grandmother riding shotgun, Sandra visible up there behind the wheel, chin lifted in a pose of moral triumph, as if she were piloting a tent revival bus on a cross-country crusade for Jesus, and had just prevailed in a moment of demonic temptation. She drove past, turned south, away from the restaurant, and headed toward the truck stop exit. Jane ran to her Ford Escape, opened the driver's door, and looked south in time to see the motorhome follow the exit road that led to the eastbound lanes of Interstate 40. As the big RV reached the bottom of that long stretch of blacktop and took the ramp to the interstate, the Jeep Cherokee followed at a discreet distance.
"But what snarky thing does it really mean?"
Jane hissed, getting behind the wheel of her car and pulling shut the door.
"Shit! Shit! Triple shit!"
She keyed the ignition. The car wouldn't start. Chapter 7. They could have known what Jane was driving only if the one who remained in the Jeep had seen her arrive. She remembered now that when she'd parked here and gotten out of the car, she had reached under her sport coat to quickly adjust the concealed carry holster. No one could have seen the pistol, but someone familiar with such a rig, like the person in the Jeep, might have realized what she was doing. While the three men had been considering her as a candidate for abduction, they smelled cop, or just competence and street smarts, no less keenly than she caught the scent of their criminal intent. Truck stops, museums, all the works of humankind were but fields and forests of another wilderness, where beasts on 2 feet stalked their own kind, each crime a symbolic act of cannibalism that spoke to a deeply entombed, but not dead, savage aspect of the human character, corrupted in some time before mere history, and ever since passed from generation to generation. The two women and two girls unknowingly cast behind them the spoor of prey, and the men in the Cherokee laid down the spoor of blood-seeking beasts. And though Jane knew them both by their trace, only the predators knew her. She got out of the Escape, popped the hood. They had not taken time to sabotage the vehicle beyond her ability to put it right. Through the restaurant window, they would have seen her slip out of the booth. If they suspected she might pause to give a word of warning to the mother of the girls, they still wouldn't have been sure if she would step outside in 2 minutes or half a minute. They had needed to avoid being caught. If she had seen them disabling the Ford, her suspicions would have been confirmed. They didn't have a sharp knife between them, or if they had one, they didn't think to use it to cut the fan belts. The ignition cables had been disconnected from the spark plugs. 4 of the plugs had been removed as well and cast aside. 1 lay against the cap of the oil pan. Another was trapped between the power steering belt and a flywheel. She took too long to find the 3rd, cradled in a niche between the starter motor and the oil pan. The 4th eluded her until she dropped to her knees and looked under the car. It had fallen past the engine block to the pavement. After she installed the spark plugs and was connecting the ignition wire boots to the plug terminals, a tall man in a cowboy hat appeared beside her.
"Can I give a hand, little lady?"
He was probably a trucker, with white hair and a white mustache and a face leathered by sun and time, 50-something, old enough to know what chivalry meant and to think that it still mattered. He wished only to help. Considering that the world needed more like him, Jane didn't dismiss him, either with a word or with a gesture. "Thanks, but I think I've got it. Some damn foolish kids pulled the plugs. I guess they figured I wouldn't know what to do. I'd have to just stand around waiting for AAA. The trucker nodded solemnly.
"I'd wager you did less to them than look askance. Everyone takes offense at the littlest nothing these days. Looks like you grown up with engines."
"I didn't, in fact, but I've learned some." She finished the job and stepped back, and the trucker closed the hood.
"Why don't I wait while you start her, just in case?"
"Appreciate it." The engine turned over on Jane's first try. When she lowered the glass to thank him, the trucker leaned close, one big hand on the windowsill.
30 years. I've driven dangerous loads for hazard pay. Didn't so much as rip a fingernail.
She needed to go, get done what had to be finished. But there was a kindness about him, and a melancholy that arrested her.
My boy, a Marine. They give him an easy assignment, protecting some State Department thing overseas. Not so easy after all. He's dead at 24. Been 6 years of lies about how, what, why. The smart people covering their butts.
He opened the hand on the windowsill, producing a card between thumb and forefinger.
That's our home address. Me and my wife. The phone number, too. No one would ever find you there.
Speechless, she took the card. His name was Foster Oswald.
I come out the lavatory behind you. Heard those ladies. Said to myself, this here is some girl. Then I saw your wedding band.
She looked at her ring hand on the steering wheel.
It's a unique design. So since this morning, it's in all the TV babble. But now, you want me to ride along? Help with those ladies?
Thanks. But no, I've got it.
Damn if you don't, girl.
Foster Oswald stepped back, and she drove fast out of the parking lot, faster still down the exit lane, and cranked the Ford up to 90 when she reached Interstate 40. Chapter 8. Jane had lost 12 minutes with the spark plugs at the truck stop. The motorhome had probably gotten 12 miles in that time. She covered that much ground in 8 minutes, during which Sandra might have put another 8 miles between them. The bastards in the flat black Cherokee wouldn't have rushed into a setup. They would have driven fast ahead of the motorhome until they found the right place to jack the women. Maybe they even knew from the start where they would do it, which meant it would happen sooner than otherwise. Flagstaff and its ponderosa pines had been put so far behind her so fast that it might have been a clairvoyant vision of a place rather than a place she had actually been. Jane pushed the car even harder until the speedometer showed 100, and then 110, and the radar detector gave her no reason to relent. She whipped from lane to lane when slower traffic appeared before her so abruptly that it seemed to be reversing at her from the east. A careless motorist changing lanes without signaling, a blown tire, a highway patrol siren signaling a chase that she couldn't win, anything could go wrong. Mile after mile, however, nothing happened except that a couple truckers air-horned her to express their disapproval. Medium light traffic, but the highway was far from lonely. The day waned quickly, though twilight remained at least half an hour away. Hijacking a motorhome on an interstate in daylight would be a bold act, the work of guys who had chemicals other than just alcohol in their blood. They couldn't block multiple lanes or risk staging a bump with a vehicle much larger than theirs and maybe lose control. She could see only one way they might do it. Fake a breakdown, flag the motorhome, hope Sandra would be civic-minded enough to pull off the road behind them. They knew her nature. They had not only been watching her, but also listening to her in the restaurant. But would two women with two children in their charge dare stop when those pretending to need help were three fit young men? The only sane answer was no. Even if Sandra had a heart bigger than her brain, she would not put her daughters in jeopardy, especially not now that she had been warned that those same three men had been watching her in the restaurant. And then Jane knew how it would surely happen. Neither Sandra nor her mother would see the three men until it was too late. The fourth person in the Cherokee, the one who hadn't come into the restaurant, must be a woman. The Jeep would be off the pavement where the shoulder opened into a wider lay-by. The woman, the shill, would be standing beside it, apparently alone and vulnerable, desperately waving for help, only when the motorhome rolled into view. She might be faking an injury, too. Beyond the shoulder of the road, the land would drop away. The men would be hiding on that slope, behind rock formations, among whatever clumps of brush there might be. The woman, their accomplice, would come around to the starboard side of the motorhome when it stopped behind the jeep, rather than to the port side, past which traffic streamed at high speed. The RV would screen her from the view of passing motorists. If the grandmother was still up front in the cockpit, when she put down the window, the apparently injured girl would have a gun. From there, it could go several ways, depending on whether the door was locked or not, depending on whether the shill shot the grandmother dead at that point or only threatened her. But of the various ways it might play out, whether deadly force was used in the first instant or not, the men would surge up the slope and be inside the vehicle in half a minute. Less. Kill the grandmother if she wasn't already dead, drag Sandra out of the driver's seat, pistol whip her into submission, take control of the two girls. They would drive the motorhome to some prearranged hiding place, a barn, any abandoned structure, and use the girls and the mother until they tired of them, strip everything of value from the vehicle, leave the murdered family behind to rot until someone stumbled on the bodies. The speedometer at 115, tires thrumming. The fierce velocity turned the dead air ahead into a buffeting wind through which the Ford cleaved, its body shimmying on its frame with a sound like an out-of-tune violin issuing a two-note oscillation under a long-enduring bowstroke. Cresting a hill, she saw a straightaway sweeping toward the east, where the far horizon darkled, and not a mile ahead, the motorhome stood roadside. She more than halved her speed, squinting at land rutilant with the light of the low sun, as if some nuclear catastrophe had rendered it radioactive and unfit to sustain life. Straining forth from every rock and signpost, elongated shadows like the spirits of those things yearned toward the coming night. Having entered the straightaway in the center lane, she could see past the motorhome to the shoulder of the highway ahead of it, where stood a dark, familiar vehicle. A man and woman were walking away from the motorhome, toward the jeep, their backs to Jane. The man might have been one of the three in the restaurant. The woman was surely the shill. From a distance, she appeared slender, perhaps 5'2", a girlish figure who would inspire sympathy if you came upon her stranded at the roadside. If those two were returning to the jeep with such nonchalance, then the hijack must be complete. Two men now aboard with the women and girls. The shill and her companion would drive ahead to prepare whatever makeshift garage for the arrival of the big RV. As though casting a spell of misdirection on the pair afoot, Jane murmured, "Don't look back, don't look back, don't look back," as she slowed and pulled into the right-hand lane, one tire on the shoulder, getting out of their line of sight behind the hijacked vehicle. Other traffic noise might have masked the sound of the Ford, but taking no chance, she killed the engine and coasted the last 100 yards. Gravel crunched under two tires until she stopped 6 feet from the motorhome. Drapery lay in soft, wide folds across the back window of the RV, but other windows might not be covered. When she got out of the escape, she didn't fully close the driver's door. The motorhome's engine was idling, condensed exhaust vapor dripping from twin tailpipes. Passing vehicles lashed her with their tails of wind as she went to the starboard side of the RV. If those drivers were curious about this roadside tableau, they restrained their curiosity with thoughts of the high price often paid these days by Good Samaritans. One door on the port side, but two doors here, one near the back, the other at the front. She resisted the temptation of the rear door, drew her pistol, and moved forward, staying close to the RV and below the glass line. She came to the door beside which the grandmother had been sitting when they left the truck stop, eased up to the window. No one in the cockpit, two empty seats. If the hijackers were in the living area or the kitchenette, which would both be open to the cockpit, they would hear the door The sudden increase in traffic noise would alone alert them. For one faint-hearted moment, she told herself that this was not her war, that these evil men were not the organized sociopaths that posed the greater danger to her future and to Travis, that they were mere amateurs at wreaking horror, not havoc-mongers of epic intentions like DJ Michael and his kind. But in truth, this wasn't one war and hers another. They were the same war, universal across all space and time, each a battle essential to sustaining the hope of an ultimate triumph. And to walk away from one skirmish was to surrender everything, everywhere, and there would be nothing then but to lay down arms and die. Past the front of the RV, she saw the Jeep Cherokee enter traffic, racing eastward toward whatever exit would take them to the place where they would celebrate and their captives would suffer. Screened from traffic, Jane took the sound suppressor from the sleeve in her shoulder rig and screwed it on the 45. She tried the vehicle door. It was unlocked. She opened it. Chapter 9. Inside the door, three low steps to the co-pilot's seat, the top step a triangle that served also for entrance to the living area behind the cockpit. No one there, neither the women nor the girls nor their captors. Beyond the living area, the open kitchen and dining nook, both likewise uninhabited. She eased the door shut and went into the living area without hesitation, having been taught that commitment required progress as quick as conditions permitted, faster than courage alone allowed. You needed to tap into something greater than courage. Depending on your philosophy, you might call that something the conviction of the well-trained, or, if you were honest with yourself, you knew it was blind faith in whatever power had ordered the universe. The slipstreams of passing 18-wheelers rocked the motorhome on its tires. She could hear her heart knocking, too, and a rushing sound in her ears that was the circulation of her blood through carotids and jugulars. If there were voices, she didn't hear them. Easing into the narrow passageway beyond the kitchen, open door to the left, shadowy bathroom beyond. At the end, a closed door to the farther bedroom. Light spilled into the passage from a room on the right. She couldn't sidle up to the jamb and peek through an open door. She had to assume instead that she'd been heard and was awaited. So she went boldly into the light that fanned the hall, into the open doorway, but low. Head and gun low, because these amateurs aimed high for the head, trained to do so by bad movies. A cramped bedroom. The one with the shaved head stood in there, his back to Jane. The grandmother slumped in a corner, bleeding from the mouth, but alive and terrified. Sandra was lying face up on the bed, hair wild, left eye swelling shut, those ever-popular cable ties zipped tight at wrist and ankles. Skinhead tore open her blouse, cloth splitting, buttons flying loose and pinging off a lamp base, clicking off a wall panel. This was neither the time nor place for rape. He was teasing himself with a preview and further terrorizing both women. Maybe he happened to glance at the grandmother and intuited the meaning of her surprised expression. Maybe he heard something. It didn't matter which. He turned toward the door and saw Jane. He didn't have a gun in hand, and the sight of her stunned him so completely that he didn't instantly reach for a weapon. That didn't matter either. She shot him, point-blank center chest, shattering the sternum, so that the hollow-point round carried bone splinters with it through his heart, which seized up around that coronet of white thorns, and he went down dead before he received the payment of pain that he had earned, fell backward onto the bed beside the shackled woman. In death, as supple as an eel, he slid slowly off the mattress and to the floor, mouth open in a silent shout, eyes as wide as they were now forever blind. The other man wouldn't have heard the suppressor-muffled shot under these circumstances. Sandra had cried out in revulsion as the corpse fell on the bed, though her cry might have been interpreted as nothing more than a response to just one more outrage committed by Skinhead. As Jane gestured at the two women to stay quiet and keep still, something big passed in the night. Maybe a Peterbilt towing two trailers, evidently in the nearest lane, making time, rocking the motorhome harder than before. From the corner of her eye, she saw movement, pivoted toward it, bringing up the Colt. But it was just the door, arcing away from her, influenced by the listing vehicle. The children must be in the back bedroom with the other creep, behind the closed door. Jane didn't want to go in there after him, putting Holly and Lauren at risk in an exchange of gunfire. But even if he did nothing but bind them, every second they were with him was an intolerable affront to their dignity. Every second, an auger bit of terror boring more painfully into their psyches. She reached for the door, which had almost closed of itself, but before she touched the knob, the remaining kidnapper called out to the dead man,
"Litvinov, let's get this shit can rolling."
The door that had just swung nearly shut was thrown open, even as the man spoke, even as Jane pivoted toward it. The white-bread escapee from Happy Days materialized on the threshold, saw Litvinov waiting for worms, and ghosted away in the same instant, even as Jane squeezed off two rounds. She hadn't wounded him because he wasn't screaming, but she hadn't killed him because there was no sound of him falling. So he was going after Holly and Lauren, maybe to use them as cover, maybe to kill them just for the perverse pleasure of it. She went through the door, down low, gun and head first, and he was to her right, his back to the master bedroom, a weapon in his hands, maybe a Glock, his first round too high, the second showering her face with chips of particle board torn from the doorframe an inch above her head. Two misses, even in that close encounter, because he was backing through the half-open door even as he squeezed off those shots. Jane couldn't shoot because of the girls, couldn't retreat because of the girls. Nothing for her but to go after the twisted bastard, pinballing across the narrow hallway to ricochet off the wall beside the bathroom, coming at him on the hard rebound, this indirect approach confusing him, so his third shot went wild as he stepped backward all the way into the bedroom, trying to close the door. She barreled in with everything she had, temporarily deaf from his gunfire, a narrowing wedge of light between door and jamb. He, the stronger of the two, but maybe rattled by her boldness. She hit the door, shoulder first, aware of a muzzle flash as he fired another round, not sure if she was hit or not. She had heard of guys who didn't know they were hit for half a minute or longer, if they were so out there on adrenaline, and if it wasn't a body core wound. He was stronger than she, but he was off balance when she slammed into the door, the wedge widening, and he reeled backward, though still on his feet. In this crisis of his making, this must have been his thinking. Maybe he could kill her, but she would at least wound him. Probably kill him. And whether or not he killed her, everything had gone wrong. His future now a black hole, drawing him to oblivion with its brutal gravity. So that what mattered most was not saving his life that he might live the pinched existence of a fugitive. No, what mattered most now was the same that mattered to King Lear in his sixth act. Kill, 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 kill. Staggering backward, he turned away from Jane and toward the girls, turned toward the girls with the gun. Scrubbed and barbered like a church boy, but more eager to slaughter the girls than to defend himself. Jane shot him three times, and if he fired a round, it missed the sisters. When he was down, and surely dead, she moved in close, and nevertheless shot him a fourth time, because the prince of this world was also the prince of hell, and full of tricks. Her hearing came back with the sobbing of the sisters, to which she would have rather remained deaf. They were unhurt but terrified, and though untouched, they had been robbed of their innocence by the recognition of evil, not as it was portrayed by Disney villains, but as it was in fact, ruthless and irrational, selfish above all else, convinced of its righteousness and of the beauty of disorder. The girls hadn't been bound, but controlled by intimidation. Calling out to the women that the sisters were safe, Jane led them to the breakfast nook where they sat at her instruction. After a hesitation, she took off her wedding band and slipped it into a pocket of her jeans. Her hands shook as she went through kitchen drawers in search of scissors. She realized she was perspiring heavily only when the sweat turned cold, an icy rivulet tracking the course of her spine. When she found what she needed, she returned to the mother and grandmother. She freed the former and assessed the injury to the latter, which was minor. The grandmother kept thanking God that it was over, but it was not over. Much needed to be done, and quickly. Chapter 10. Sandra Termindale, mother of Holly and Lauren, daughter of Pamela, wanted to thank their rescuer and didn't know how. Found each attempt inadequate, which didn't matter because Jane wasn't interested in thanks, only in cooperation. The women and girls were in the breakfast nook. Sandra couldn't stop touching her children, stroking their hair. She couldn't stop crying, either, though this wasn't a weeping that shook and disabled her. These were tears of relief, a long, liquid unwinding of tension. "We don't even know your name," Sandra said. "No," Jane said, "you don't."
"What is your name?"
"Alice Liddell," Jane lied. Standing by the kitchen sink, she ejected the magazine from her pistol. 5 rounds remained in it. She replaced it with a spare.
"Thank God you don't need that anymore," said Pamela.
Jane had left the bedrooms dark, but for a dimmed lamp in each. Now she turned out all the lights in the front of the vehicle except for a small ceiling fixture over the nook. The late light at the windows provided only the hot, cold glow of the day sky burning out.
"We don't want it dark," Pamela said.
"Yes, we do," Jane said. "Draw as little attention as we can."
"The children are frightened. Turn on the lights."
Jane addressed the girls.
"You don't look like Marshmallow Marjories. You look boy tough. You've got it together, am I right?"
"Maybe,"
Holly said.
Lauren said,
"We could, I guess."
"Good. Great. Everything will be okay." To Sandra, she said, "I've got to have a word with you. Just the two of us." Sandra didn't want to leave her girls, but she accompanied Jane through the shadowy living area to the front of the vehicle, where they sat in the cockpit chairs. Louder here, the engine idled in a 3-note cycle, a mechanical lullaby. The sun balanced on the horizon behind them, visible in the extended side mirrors of the RV, bloody red and immense. As the light failed westward, darkness climbed the eastern sky, stippled with suns so distant that they gave no heat. "Listen," Jane said. "The two who left in the Cherokee, they're expecting their friends maybe 30 minutes behind them, with you and the girls. When that doesn't happen, they'll come back to see why." Shock staunched the woman's tears.
"We need the police."
Jane remained patient. "Sandy, that's the last thing I need. If a cop stops to see why you've pulled over, which could happen any minute, that's as bad for me as if the pair in the Jeep come back."
"I don't understand."
"You don't need to, Sandy. If you really want to thank me, then help me get those two out of here as soon as it's dark."
"What two?"
"The dead guys."
"Out of here? To where?"
"Over the shoulder of the road. Roll them down the embankment."
"Oh my God. No. No. No, I don't want to touch them."
"They're too heavy. I need help."
"They're dead."
"Very. So they can't hurt you."
This is a crime scene or something. Isn't it a crime scene?
Not if no one knows there's been a crime.
We can't pretend it didn't happen. The police have to know.
Jane put a gentling hand on the woman's shoulder. You realize what'll happen to your kids if there's an investigation?